Radio.
What a credit of yours that I might know.
Well, that's part of the problem, Jerry, is I don't have enough, so you probably know.
Are you insane?
They are insane!
You're in the hands of an adolescent.
It is a cellular peptide cake.
Inaccurate. But Matt Boston.
It does like you.
Mr. Kim.
Hi, Christopher. I'm Nero.
How you doing, Mike?
Ghostbusters!
McCoy, you read me. Ruth, how can it be you? How can you possibly be? You haven't aged. It's been 15 years.
It doesn't matter. None of that matters.
You're damn straight, none of it matters. I'm Mike McCafferty. I just want to talk about Star Trek. You know these things. You're tuning in because you just want to hear me talk about Star Trek. And here's the thing, is that I've been working up to do... See, I love Star Trek, but sometimes in some of my podcasts, it seems like I don't, right? Like a lot of these, I make fun of them, like a piece of the action or the way to Eden or whatever, you know, whatever, move along home. They're fun, right? We like to kind of like make fun of them. But then sometimes I worry, people think I actually don't like Star Trek because all I do is like rail on it and make fun of it. But I do. I love Star Trek. I love everything about it, which is why I can make fun of it. That seems like counterintuitive, but it's true. And so in order to prove the fact that I actually do love Star Trek and I do love certain episodes, I've been working up to this weekend doing The City on the Edge of Forever. It's such a great episode. And I watched the episode and I was so excited. It just so entranced me. Sometimes I don't like to watch that one because it hurts me how good it is and how painful it is for Captain Kirk. I did all my research and I was ready. I was like, okay, on Sunday night, I'm going to go ahead and record that episode. I'm going to push that out there and damn it, it's going to be great because I haven't been around that much. I've been doing all this writing for Disney and I just finished a Hallmark film I wrote for and all this nonsense that doesn't matter. It doesn't matter at all. Although there is some Star Trek references in certain projects I've been doing that people don't know about. I've hidden them in there once they're, you know, shot and distributed. I'll tell you all about that. Well, there's in my Hallmark film that I'm writing, there's a band called Kirk and the Trelanes. And I seriously doubt that my development executive is listening to this podcast or that she knows what Kirk and the Trelanes mean. So let's all pray that gets in there. Be that as it may, I was all excited to do this. To do this big, like, just go for it. Like, why don't I just go for it instead of, like, just, like, sniping around the edges and getting all the, you know, like, I'm, like, some sort of entrepreneurial jackal taking out the weakest of the animals, you know, being very Darwinian and, you know, the weakest shall die and the strongest survive, you know, oh, gosh, let's do Plato's Stepchildren. Oh, how hard is it to make fun of that? No, let's go for The City on the Edge of Forever. And then I got sidetracked, and I fall into the minutiae. See, I'm sort of like a binar. To my credit or my detriment in my life, and this show is about me and my life and my midlife crisis. I feel like I'm going through it again a little bit this summer. I've got some ideas what I'm going to do again, but I can't do the middle ground. I should be a good podcaster and just play the middle ground in every episode, talk about just bullshit, just nonsense. Nonsense. I'm using the word bullshit because my guest in this episode uses the word bullshit, but I can't help it. I'm a binar. I'm one or zero. So either I'm going to go for it, I'm going to go for the brass ring. Let's talk about City on the Edge of Forever or The Balance of Terror, which we talked about before. Or let's talk about the most inane, weird thing I can think of. I wanted to talk about Star Trek II's guy who shines the floor, who mops the floor. I wanted to talk with Kim Miller, the doctor, but she didn't remember that. I'm like, what? How can you not remember that? Because no one remembers that. No one knows what that is except me. Because I'm fixated on these little things. Because I care about this and I'm fascinated about it. What is this leading up to? Well, it's leading up to the fact that for some reason I couldn't find a sound clip for the last podcast. For some reason, it's the opening music for this. For some reason, my computer ate it. It's like, it just like, oh, no, that music doesn't exist. Like, of course it exists. It was there the whole time. And I had to go back and I had to re-download it. And then I was thinking, well, where's some of my other music? Some of my other music's gone. And in particular, some of my Star Trek music. I told you before I wanted to play The Enterprise Clears Its Moorings, one of my favorite songs, with my new car. It's not a new car. It's 2011 Kia Soul. It's within this decade, for God's sakes, instead of my 2003 Ford Focus. Which got in a car accident and wrecked it, and I did a great podcast about that, except I didn't record it properly, and that's not your fault, that's my fault. I know we're burning valuable podcasts here, but we're getting to a point of my madness. So I was trying to get all my old Star Trek songs in there, and one of them was Ruth. I just played this for you, right? I just played this for you a second ago. This is from Shore Leave, late first season original series episode, shot early, so some of the characters are a little wonky. Shot early, shown late, where they go to a strange planet where everything that you think of comes true. It's an amusement park planet. That's exactly what they say. And the crew doesn't know that, so all these thoughts they have become dangerous. It's a good episode because it allows us to see what our characters' inmost thoughts and desires are. And one of them is for Ruth. Ruth is Kirk's love from 15 years ago, he says, which I guess they met when they were 19. I guess that works. He says he's 34 years old in the deadly years. So you go back, that makes him 19, which I guess is okay. It's kind of still like a weird relationship between the two of them, but whatever. So anyway, so I love this piece of music. It's so beautiful. It's so haunting. And it's so overwrought, too. Listen to it again. It's so over-the-top melodramatic. I used it in the Star Trek improv show I did about, 15 to 17 years ago. 15 years ago. Boy, Shatner's really laying it on thick there with the acting, right? He's matching the melodrama, the overdramatic reach of this piece of music. But damn it, if I don't love it. It's so simple. It's this flute with strings in the middle and like a bass fiddle and a cello underneath it. It's so simple. And so pure, and it reflects this innocent love that Kirk has for Ruth. Ruth. It's not the most beautiful name to have, I guess. I mean, well, Ruth's actually a great name, but it's not like Celestia or Galvanitra or something like that. It's Ruth. Like, hey, what's up, Ruth? Kirk, Ruth, sure, why not? So I really, really loved this song for a long time, but there's something that bugged me about it. The beginning of this song, and I'll play it for you again, but don't freak out, has a weird, off-putting dissonance to it with the cello. It's like I told you, you have this flute at the top. Na, 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 na. And then in the middle you have the strings. And then you have this cello, which for the life of me sounds off. Na. You hear it? Listen to it again. Listen. It's like the note is wrong. But I sat there for the longest time going, this can't be right, right? I mean, this is actually recorded. This was recorded and played on network television and then released on a CD in the 1990s that I bought and I played over and over again. It must be me, right? I have to be the person who's wrong on that. Yet the more I listened to over the years, the more I thought, I can't be crazy on this. But then, something happened. As our erstwhile friend, Petty Officer, what is Jason? Jason's Petty Officer, or he's Acting Chief Jason McCarris, friend of the podcast, sometimes podcaster on I Just Want to Talk About Star Trek. He was watching Shore Leave, of his own volition. I didn't force him to, but or maybe I did force him. I can't remember. But he was talking about, he said, hey, what's up with that weird note in Shore Leave, in Ruth? And I was like, what? You hear that too? And Jason, he knows his music. He plays piano. He sings. And so he knew that there's something weird about that. So, oh, I'm not crazy. There is something weird about this. So, as I was saying, I went back and I started to find all my old music. And there was Ruth. Track number 4 and track number 8. This is track number 4. It's actually a little bit longer than the other one you've been hearing, because it has a bridge. But there's a weird note in the beginning. How can that be? I still thought I might be crazy. So I did what everyone does nowadays. I Googled it. I thought it's crazy, but why don't I Google it? So I typed in Star Trek, Ruth, out of tune. And I found on Film Score Bulletin Board, a website called Film Score, there was a cached bulletin board, which doesn't exist anymore, but in 2005, Pooter posted the following thing. Has anyone noticed the cue from the original series episode Shore Leave, which is called Ruth? It was used again extensively in This Side of Paradise. It begins with a pleasant enough melody, but the cello playing is like completely out of tune. It sounds horrible and actually quite funny. Anyone else notice this? Others did. Scott M., yeah, I did. Pretty distracting. Mooney said it took a couple listens to hear it. To me, it's hardly noticeable. But on and on it went on. More and more people said, I did notice it. People were conjecturing, is it the correct note? Or is it part of an orchestration that Gerald Fried used? I actually contacted someone who had, his name is Heath, who had actually, he went and tried to put the correct note in it. And I emailed him because he had a little MP3, but it didn't work. I said, where is it? He says, oh, I took it off. I felt kind of weird about that. I said, no, I need that. He says, well, you know, I don't want to like go against Gerald Fried's compositions and stuff like that. So I'll send it to you if I find it. I was like, okay. So then I thought, what if I just contact Gerald Fried? Or Fried, I think it's Fried. Now, he's still alive. He's 89 years old, according to Wikipedia, but he's still alive. Could I find him? Again, I went to the internet. I read articles on him. I found out in one of the articles he listed where he's living. And then I looked him up. I looked him up on the internet, and I found a phone number. And today I called him. And today, he returned my call. Sometimes going after minutiae pays off. I've been so fixated, this has become my obsession, this has become my white whale, that I got an interview with Gerald Fried, I think it's Fried, F-R-I-E-D, it's Fried, but I think he calls it Fried. He called back, and I talked to him, it was a great conversation, and I asked him about this, and I played him the note, it's really, really good, but I asked him about other stuff too, about Amok Time, about the Finnegan song, about all this great stuff. And you're going to hear that in a couple seconds. I've been talking to you for so long that I buried the lead, which is that we have a great interview with Gerald Fried. I don't know if there's anything else I'm supposed to tell you about this, except I was super excited about this. Now, do we get to the bottom of this? Well, I'll let you decide for yourself. I think I have my answer. But here's the final little thought I'll give to you, even though I'm going to kind of like reverse engineer this, is that no matter what the answer is, I'll always hear that slightly different note. And so even though for a long time I thought that note has to be wrong, now I hear it as right. And maybe you'll hear it too. All right, I've talked enough. Let's listen to this pretty kick-ass interview. And it's a little soft because he's calling on his phone and my volume's turned way up. With legendary composer Gerald Fried.
Hello?
Jerry?
Yeah.
Hey, it's Mike McCafferty again.
Okay.
Okay. How are you today?
Not bad. We're in the midst of moving, which is always, a stressful situation.
Oh. Where are you going?
We're going to Southern Connecticut. Why? Because Anita, my wife's family, is all in Massachusetts and Vermont and New Hampshire. My whole family is in New York, Jersey, and D.C. So this place is right in the middle, so we expect a lot of visits from grandkids and all that stuff. I even have a granddaughter that I haven't met yet. She's over a year old.
Oh, wow. Well, I'm glad I caught you before you left.
Yes.
I tracked you down. I've had this question for a while. First of all, I am so thrilled to be talking to you. You are so exciting to me. I love your music. I love everything you've written for Star Trek.
Oh, thank you. Oh, okay.
Yes, and I can name off several cues. Leg Trick with Finnegan's theme, so good. Ah, so amazing. Ruth. And of course, the fight music, all this stuff is so great. And you are like this icon to Star Trek.
Well, that's a nice place to be. Thank you.
No, you're welcome. And I remember you on the Sci-Fi Channel, I think, playing clarinet because you were selling one of your albums. Do you remember that?
No, I never played. I played professional clarinet, but what you heard was me on oboe.
Oh, it was the oboe. Well, that shows my level of knowledge of the woodwinds. But was that you who was on there? I think you were playing.
Yeah.
And you played that the Finnegan's theme. Dun da 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 da. Right?
Yeah, I did.
And you were great. You were so good.
I'm still playing professional oboe here in Santa Fe, and I will probably continue in Connecticut.
So you're going to move to Connecticut. That's great. And so you're going to keep on playing in Connecticut. Is that right?
I hope to, yeah. I'm in my 90th year, so you can't guarantee too much.
Oh, my gosh. Jerry, I'm talking to you, but 50 years ago, you were recording music for this goofy science fiction show. Did you ever think that 50 years later, some weirdo would be tracking you down to ask you questions?
I'm sure on some level, my fantasies projected that, yeah. That's one of the reasons that you bust your ass and stay up all night and try to write your best up, because you'll make a connection and who knows, on some Sunday night somewhere, this guy might call. And here he is.
Yes, this is it. You've reached, this is the pinnacle of fame, Jerry. Me talking to you on a Sunday night. Can you believe it?
Sure. When it comes like that, I'll believe anything.
Yeah. Now, you went to school in Juilliard, is that right? Did I read that right?
I was a vocal major at Juilliard.
Wow, how was that? Was that hard? Was it amazing?
It's always hard. You're at a major institution, and you get the people who are going to become the major oboe players of the country for the next 40 years. Yeah, but I kept up with them.
What drove you from, because you obviously, you're a great oboe player, an oboist. What drove you to decide to try composing?
When I was 12 and 13, my two ambitions were to play piano with Tommy Dorsey and to play saxophone with Glenn Miller.
Wow.
So I didn't think much about it, and life went on. I went to Juilliard, and they assigned me oboe. If you audition on piano at Juilliard, they figure out, if you have the right amount of teeth and stuff, they'll give you an orchestral instrument. So they gave me oboe. And it was like a good thing that happened to me. Now, how I got into writing music for movies is an interesting story. And I could tell you a lot of bullshit about, you know, how my magnificent talent was heard by the people in the industry, and they just couldn't wait to get to my doorstep. The truth is, I was hanging around. This is in New York City. I went to the High School of Music and Art in New York City, and then my high school, my final years there and the early years in Juilliard, I was 16, 17, 18. I was hanging around with a bunch of Greenwich Village nerds who, they sounded like they knew about everything. They just knew kids my own age. Gee, I want to hang out with these guys. They're fascinating. One of those nerds said that we were only 19 at the time. That, you know, he put his money into a movie, he made a short subject, and he would like me to do the music. Why me? Because he confessed I was the only musician he knew. So, you know, he said, "No, can you parlay being an overmaid at Juilliard into, you know, writing and synchronizing and conducting a dramatic score?" "Oh, hell yeah," I said. "All of the overmaids at Juilliard do that." Anyway.
So that's what started you out. That's how you just kind of said, "Sure, why not?" And then that's what got you going.
Yeah, but I got a punchline. Let me finish this.
Oh, story. Yeah, oh, good. Sorry, yeah.
It was an interesting short. It was quite good, as a matter of fact. And we wrote it for RKO Pathé, which was the news arm of RKO Pictures. And they hired him again to do another picture to them, and they hired me again. I was still 19 at the time to write more. Anyway, the punchline of this whole story is that nerds turn out to be Stanley Kubrick.
Ah.
Now that's for a break.
So you did the music for his short? Is that what you're telling me?
His short and the next four pictures of his, yeah.
That's how you got your start working for Stanley Kubrick.
And working for anybody. Well, my first introduction to the movie business.
Wow, that's a pretty lofty place to start.
Yeah, I always enjoy telling that story.
That's a great story. Wow, what got you into Star Trek? How did you get? What got you the connection? I know you did some Mission Impossible cues and songs.
Do you want the truth or do you want the bullshit?
Which one's better?
Actually, I'll go for the truth on this one. the bullshit was that, I met Gene Roddenberry and those guys, and a mystical cloud developed over our head, and we just knew that we had to work on Star Trek together. The truth of the matter is, my agents figured, you know, with my credits, I was one of the guys they would just love to hear. And from their point of view, they gave my agent a call and say, "Hey, tell me about Gerald Reed. Is he available?" and all that stuff. So they put the deal together, so I just showed up one morning.
Oh, okay. I like the first story, but this is definitely more factual. So you did five episodes overall. Is that correct?
Of that first year, yeah, I think I'm not sure I got the numbers correct, but 5 or 6 sounds right.
Yeah, let me see. I had a list here. You did Shore Leave, which is, I want to talk to you about that in a minute. You did Amok Time.
Right.
You did This Side of Paradise, I believe.
Yep.
Is that the right one?
Let me see.
Yeah, let's see. You also did, oh, Cat's Paw. Cat's Paw's a crazy one, isn't it?
Yep, I did that too.
And I'm trying to see if there's any other ones you did. I'm looking here.
Mentioned Friday's Child.
No, I didn't mention. You did that one too, so I think that's the fifth.
Okay.
Which one was your favorite? Or were you just like, "Man, I'm so busy, boom, get this out, you know, next show"?
No, Star Trek wasn't quite like that. I did two shows that had a nice, comfortable fantasy aura about them. Like, they were more important than just TV shows. One was Star Trek, the other one was Roots.
Oh, that's right. You won an Emmy for Roots.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
I guess Shore Leave was my favorite. It stands to do a lot of things you don't normally do in a movie, like, you know, that Irish jig.
You did the Irish jig. You have the sort of medieval theme. Dun, 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 dun.
Right.
And then you have you also have a tiny cue of a samurai warrior.
Oh, yeah.
Very briefly. It certainly put you through your paces because you were trying to catch up. And, of course, you had the White Rabbit theme.
Oh, yeah. That was there, too, yeah.
So tell me, like, walk me through this. They get you the edit for, like, a Star Trek, or let's just say anything, and you sit down, you watch the episode, and then you start scoring it, or do you talk to someone? They say, we want this to be funny, we want this to be sad. What's that process?
Absolutely. We have an initial screening, and I look at it, and afterwards I sit down. Bob Johnson was always there. Gene Roddenberry showed up once in a while. And occasionally the writers of each one might show up.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a special music session. And then we went through the whole picture. Should there be music here? And if so, what should it do? How will it affect the audience at this point? And tell us in what way. So, And with people like Roddenberry, who was very sharp, I say, oh, was sharp. Justin was sharp. It was a pleasure. They were intelligent. And if you come up, I don't remember one now, though maybe by the end of this conversation, the places where I would suggest something because they were, you know, bright people. You know, this wouldn't be the usual way to do this scene, but what if we did? And it made the audience focus on X or Y, and almost always they would say, yeah, go for it.
Okay, so they kind of followed your cue. Pun, I guess, with what you thought was intuitively right.
I guess the word intuitively has to be used because you don't have empirical evidence. You know, if we ran the show for 30 million people and then, you know, took notes, then we'd have some empirical evidence, but it's intuitive at that level, yeah.
Okay. I was gonna follow that up with. Were there ever any cues that they said, "No, that's not working. Try it again"?
That almost never happened to me. Mostly because we had these pre-recording sessions and we flashed it out pretty much carefully, and I took notes and all that.
Mm-hmm. So they sat in on like your sort of pre-recording stuff, and then they give you notes from that. So that by the time the song was finished, they had no more notes.
No pre-recording. There's no time in television for that luxury. Just that conversation where I put into words what I expected the music to do was what we made our decisions on. I'm sure that I'm not thinking of it, but I'm sure there's something in all the Star Trek and all the other works I did where I got into an argument or they said, no, this ain't going to work. Oh, yes. Something of that Roman music. Stan Margulies did a two-hour movie about the ambassador or something like that. And I wrote a theme. I thought it would be Italian-oriented. The embassy was in Italy. And he said, no, that's not going to work. So I did have something in all my, you know, million years of composing that was actually replaced.
Well, that's not a bad ratio, though. I mean, have one thing out of hundreds of TV and movie cues. Right?
Yeah.
Now there's only five of these episodes. Was there one of them that you were like, ooh, boy, I don't know what's going on in this episode. I'm just going to write some music and pray that it works out?
I don't think that ever happened to me. I stick with the work print until I say, oh, of course this is what they must mean, and go for it. Maybe there are shades of meaning that we disagreed, but No, I never wrote anything, and you know, like a Hail Mary football pass. I never did anything like that. I was pretty much sure that what I'm writing will work.
Ah. Tell me if you remember about the Paradise Syndrome. That's the one where he goes into sort of the Native American culture. Did you draw on any sort of Native American, like folk tunes that you knew of, or did you just kind of create it from scratch? How did that work?
In those years when I was doing that, the Star Trek episode, I wrote two Native American movies. One was the story of Chief Joseph called I Will Fight No More Forever.
Mm.
Another one was called The Mystic Warrior, based on Ruth Beebe's book, Hunter Yo. So I did a lot of research at the UCLA Library.
Oh.
Native American music. So, and then this came along, so much of my homework was done already.
Well, that's good, because now you could just plug that in, because you're obviously moving quickly, and you could, like, I got this.
Yeah, that comes the point where you say, okay, this problem is solved, go on to the next one. Yeah, and it was easier with, what was it called, Paradise Syndrome,
Okay. Which is a pretty good episode. You know, I'm looking at your episodes, and you have some of the better episodes of all of them. So you a combination of good scripts and good music has turned them into great episodes. Tell me, I mean, you probably talked about this 1,000 times before, but Amok Time, what influences did you draw upon to create that alien sound for Planet Vulcan? You know, to get that kind of, you know, drums and an odd sound. What did you draw upon for that?
One was my personal belief that percussion is kind of the heart of music. You know, people all have heartbeats and they all have body rhythms.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, we are used to being influenced by a steady beat. So that was easy. And incidentally, Stanley Kubrick, when he went to high school, he was a drummer, and he and I agreed on that. We were both kind of percussion happy.
Ah.
And how do you get tension, you know, 20th century? All ears are used to crash, bang, you know, these jangled, distorted, aggressive chords. But how do you make that primitive? Okay, so, and this I learned from Igor Stravinsky.
Mm.
He sounded as primitive as anybody, and everybody thinks that he was a very atonal composer, which he was not. Not only was tonal, but he got the Stravinsky sound by juxtaposing two, you know, a triad. Are you a composer, or do you know about notating music?
I know enough to say I know enough and be wrong. So don't slow it down for us. Give us everything you got.
The basis of Western music, by that I mean Mozart, Beethoven, Bach, is the triad. Bum, 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 bum.
Right.
That's a powerful sound that you can't ignore. It's strong and it connects with everybody. So, what if, and this is what Stravinsky did, you throw, let's say, that was an F major triad, bah, 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 up against that at the same time, like that was the right hand, and then an octave on the left hand, you throw an F sharp major triad, bah, 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 bah. So you have three notes of the building block of music, the triad, absolutely clashing with each other, a half tone apart. The F sharp in the bass and the F natural triad in the right hand. And that was the basic of the ba 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 ba. That's the combination.
Wow, so you basically had six notes within like a half tone of each other in a lot of times. Is that correct? Because you're playing an F chord and an F sharp? Is that what you're telling me?
That's telling you.
Wow. Well, it certainly, it was Alien, and it was great. You know, when I got married, we had a big band play at our wedding, and I tried to get them to play that theme, and they could not figure it out to save their lives. So it's, you know, it they were like, we don't, just play it on a CD. So we had to play that. It was very, very frustrating.
You still live in California?
I do. I live in Los Angeles, right? I live in Hollywood. I'm a writer and an actor.
All right. If you ever get married again, call me and I'll do the music for your wedding and play those combinations.
Oh, I... Hold on a second. Honey? Sarah? Sarah? Hey, honey? She's not around. I don't know where she went. I was going to divorce her and remarry her just for that. To have you come and play, oh my God, that would have been the best. That's amazing. That's great. So, Jerry, one thing I want to ask you, I mean, because I don't want to take up too much of your time here today, although I could. This is. I'm so thrilled about all this. But there's been a little bit of a debate about one of your cues in Shore Leave, and I told you a little bit about it. Ruth. You know the theme for Ruth?
Yeah.
It's beautiful. I love it. It is perfect falling in love music. Do you have any story behind that before I ask you this question, or how did you come up with that?
Well, I tried writing the most touching, sentimental music I can think of, but bearing in mind that the Star Trek audience, they're not interested in Tchaikovsky's, you know, overripe music dripping all over each other. They want a more austere thing. That's in my generation and lots of listening. So I try to keep it simple and pure, and came up with that one.
It's beautiful. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, there's a couple of guys, I think in Canada, and another in England, who asked my permission to have that played at their funeral.
Wow.
Somehow, I was very tickled by that.
That is beautiful. That's amazing. Okay, so let me ask you this question then, because you're talking about being simple and not Tchaikovsky or Stravinsky or one of these people who uses all those dissonant tones. In the CD, and maybe actually in the recording, the cello, when it starts out, has kind of a weird... Because you have the flute overhead, you have the strings in the middle, and you have the cello underneath. And let me quote what someone said here on Film Score magazine. It says, "Has anyone noticed the cue from the original series episode Shore Leave, Ruth? It begins with a pleasant enough melody, but the cello playing is like completely out of tune. Has anyone noticed this?" And then people start talking. They say, "Well, no, that's on purpose. It's dissonant. It's not." And so there's a long debate about it.
Could you do me a favor? Could you play it for me right now?
As though I have it queued up? Of course I can. Hold on a second. I'm going to put it up to the microphone. Take a listen. It's that opening, like that cello. Can you hear it? Want me to play it one more time, or?
Yeah, the flute is so predominating, it's hard to hear the cello.
Let me play this one more time. Maybe I can hum it along really.
Sloppy playing on the cello player's part, but I wouldn't call it that it reached out of tune. It's maybe surprising that you know, in that simple, almost folk melody, there would be that passing tone. But no, I think they're being a little too judgmental.
But you have to understand. Everything in Star Trek is analyzed, Jerry, and people, let me see if I can read some of this stuff. The first note in the cello in Ruth theme is an F. Your piano pitch life is correct. Let me see if someone else has someone else. Someone says that the cello player is out of tune. Someone says that they're playing a B when they should be playing a C. So you think it's all right, but the cello is a little sloppy. Is that what you're saying?
As of now. But if this is going to, you know, be taken seriously, I should really have a chance to listen to it, you know, where I can hear everything, like the original recording. The problem with that is that all of my studio is already packed. It's on its way to Connecticut, and I won't be able to get on it till, you know, a month or so.
Oh, but no. That's terrible. So let me just ask this. I mean, it sounded like you were writing it fairly straightforward and you weren't trying to create anything like unusual or dissonant. So if people are hearing that, it might be because the cello is a little over aggressive. Would that be fair to say, or?
Perhaps. Or perhaps the listeners were not able to negotiate in that very tonal triadic piece of music that there were some passing tones that kind of got under their skin. I'd have to hear it under best circumstances. And what's more, I love this conversation. I mean, who'd have thought that I'd be having a conversation out here about a note I wrote a million years ago?
I am so glad we're having this. Last night, I've listened to this, you know, the CD like a million times, and then I played it for a friend. He's like, "Hey, what's going on with Ruth? Why is that opening passage like that?" And then I went on the internet, and like people, I was like, "Oh my gosh, people are talking about this." So we might have to dig deep in this, Jerry. You might in Connecticut. You might have to unpack everything, and figure this out for us.
Okay.
Here, I'll read you one thing that someone says. As you'll hear, the cello plays an incorrect low B in the first take. The second take features the harmonically correct low C instead. Urban myth or not, you decide. So people are digging deep. They want the truth, Jerry.
I don't remember that passage, but that sounds very much like this guy knows what he's talking about. And there's a recording, and the B came later early. He sounds like he could very easily be right.
Well, I think he actually plays cello as well, so I think he actually created a version with his take on it with the cello. He was so, like, there's other people who are focused on this, Jerry. This is from 2005. Okay. 12 years ago, people were thinking about this. And we're getting to the bottom of this. So is it possible the cello player played a little flat and then kind of corrected?
Yeah, even though these studio players are great, you know what I mean? At that point, the viola player did something and he said, "Ooh, gee, I'm a bit behind," and hurried it up when he shouldn't have. Absolutely, even with these great studio players.
How long would a studio player have? Like, how long did you have to record these tracks?
One pass at it. And then we record.
You're kidding. So they got one rehearsal, and then boom, and then never again.
That's almost always the way it worked, yes.
Wow. That's amazing. So
these guys are great. The studio guys out there are great.
Oh, I can't, you know, like I'm an actor, and sometimes, you know, I do TV and film, and if you gave me one rehearsal and then go, it would be terrible. In fact, 10 times I'm terrible. But the think of these guys doing it one and done.
What are credits of yours that I might know?
Well, that's part of the problem, Jerry, is I don't have enough, so you probably know. I've done episodes of The West Wing. I don't know if you've ever heard of that. Let's see, what else? I do a lot of commercials. I've been on a Geico commercial, and I did National Treasure 2. If you've heard that movie, Idiocracy. You ever heard of that movie?
Not sure of that one.
Okay. Should I just bullshit you and tell you I've been in Star Wars? How about that?
About that what? Star Wars, did you say?
I could just BS you and tell you I was in Star Wars, and then we'd all be happy, right?
You could have fooled me. I think
have you ever heard of Luke Skywalker? That's me. I'm Luke Skywalker.
Fair enough. Okay.
Why not, right? It's Sunday night. We're just having fun. Well, Jerry, I don't want to take any more of your time. This has been such a great conversation. Tell me, just briefly, what's your favorite cue or song in Star Trek, and what's your favorite piece of music you've ever written? So give me two answers.
Oh, boy.
Are they all your babies?
They keep changing.
Yeah.
One of them I know was my old percussion score for Stanley Kubrick's Paths of Glory.
Okay.
But that was a good idea, except for a few, you know, Viennese waltzes with all percussion, and it had kind of a grim coldness, which I thought matched the movie very well. So that's one I'll put out there. Usually it's the last movie I thought about or talked about.
Well, I'll take that. What's your favorite? Tell me what your favorite Star Trek cue was, or do you even remember those that well?
I smile every time I think of the Irish Chick in Shore Leave.
Oh, it's so good! It's so good, Jerry. I play it all the time. It's so light and fun. That whole sequence with Finnegan is completely crazy, isn't it? I mean, he's just an insane person running around.
Yeah. And it's a fantasy. I put a lot of faith in fantasy in the art. And this Charlie person, this wizard on this planet, has the ability to look into your mind and figure out what you really want to think about and redo. So it's a fantasy beginning, and I just like the concept. He wanted to beat this Irish bully.
Yes, as we must beat all Irish bullies.
You have an Irish name. Are you an Irish bully?
Well, I'm an Irishman. Maybe I'm bullying you into this podcast, Jerry. You have full right to beat the crap out of me if you want. That's your call. I'll make, you know.
Who wrote that? Was that Theodore Sturgeon who wrote that?
It might be. That was an early one. Let me see if I can look that up. Because that's a good one. That was a fun one. Hey, you also did a bunch of Gilligan's Island, didn't you?
Yep, I did.
Love Gilligan's Island. Did you write cues for all of that? Or did you just, like, recycle some? Because you did, like, 50 episodes of Gilligan's Island.
I did not do the first year of Gilligan's Island. Johnny Williams did that. But I did years 2, 3, and 4. And it was a lot of fun. I loved it.
Did you do all the music for it? Or did other people do it? Or was it just...
Well, once I got into a groove doing it and the producers liked what I was writing... they didn't see any reason to change. I was never late. I always got the things done on time. So, yeah, I did all of them. The theme was... Sherwood Shorts gets credit for it. I changed it enough so that on a few cues, I got joint credits for using the theme.
No.
But it was mostly his. And I like telling the story about myself. People ask me, oh, you're a film composer. Well, what have you done? So my first instinct is to show off what a high-class composer I am. So I mentioned things like, did the Stanley Kubrick movies. I did One Potato, Two Potato. I did The Bell Jar, his literary work. And they said, oh, that's wonderful. And then I said, I also did Gilligan's Island. They fall on their face.
Oh, are you kidding? It's a cult classic now. I grew up on that.
Yeah.
And, you know, because they re-ran that so much, Jerry, just like with Star Trek, those themes, I can still sing you some of those themes in your episode. Do you remember the one where Gilligan got super strong and he could lift stuff? Like they all got like powers and Gilligan could lift stuff?
Yeah, I think so.
This is the theme for it. Dun 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 dun. I still remember that.
You have a good voice.
Oh, thank you. I used to be in a musician as well. I was in an a cappella quartet. So, and then I gave it all up to pursue podcasting.
Well, this was in Los Angeles.
Me? Yeah, I'm in Los Angeles right now.
Yeah, and when you were doing all those other things, like the choir and the singing.
That was back in Michigan. I grew up in Michigan.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And then I came out here, and people loved a cappella quartets in Michigan, but out here, they don't care about them. So we moved out here, and we kind of broke up because there wasn't a big market for us. It was kind of weird.
Anyway, I'd like to continue this conversation, but like I said, when my life is put back together, so give me 3 or 4 weeks, my email will remain the same. I don't know what my new phone number is, but it's in Bridgeport, Connecticut. It's at a senior citizen home called Watermark.
Okay. What? I don't think I have your email. Can you give me your email real quick?
Sure. Lowercase.
Mm-hmm.
DERRYFRIED. That's one word, of course. Jerry Fried at AOL.com.
Okay, it was Jerry with a G, right?
Right.
Okay. Well, I'm going to in 3 or 4 weeks, I'm going to give you a subtle bump about that because we have to know. We need you to listen to Ruth and figure out what's going on with that.
Yeah, I'm curious.
Okay. Jerry, thank you so much for spending some time with me on this Sunday.
Thank you for bringing back old friends to my mind.
Not at all. Have a safe trip. Have a safe move.
Thank you.
And I hope to talk to you soon.
Sounds good to me.
All right. Thanks, Jerry. Have a good night.
You too.
Okay, bye. And there we go. So I think we have a little bit of clarity. My feeling is on this, based off what he was telling me, is that this was kind of like a one-and-done kind of thing. They rehearsed it, they went for it, and this cello player was a little loosey-goosey with that first note, those first couple of notes, and they came out kind of flatty, sharpy. And then he kind of, figured it out and then went for it. And 50 years later, this mystery, this conspiracy, is almost put to bed. But we have more information. And we got to talk to one of the composers of Star Trek. Amazing. Oh, so good. I'm so excited about this. This was such a great call. And you got to be part of it. I don't care that much whether or not you listen to this or not. I care that I did the talking, because that's important for me. Man, I was going to talk about some other stuff. I was actually going to talk about City on the Edge of Forever, but this got in my bonnet last night, and then I found him. And that was great. Wow. All right, I'm going to go towel off. This has been great. Thank you so much for sticking with me on this stuff. I promise you, we're almost out of the woods of me doing this this work. I'm using quotes on this stuff, this writing for Disney nonsense. We're going to get all this together, and then we're just going to go for it this summer, and it's going to be amazing. And stuff like this is living, breathing proof of how fucking awesome this is. Better than Trek FM. They talk to themselves. They talk about themselves. We talk about stuff that matters. I'm Mike McCafferty. And I just want to talk about Ruth. Na, 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 na. Na na na. Na 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 na. Na na na. Na 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 na. Na na na. Na 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 na. Na 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 na. Na na. Bum 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 bum.
Destruct sequence completed and engaged.
Don't you understand?
Anything but this.
When the train comes in, everybody rides.
Daddy Lil Odin, sir, at your service.
Your daddy can put them up, can he?
Mark a somber emotional state. No.
Rodriguez to Captain Kirk.
Yes, Mr. Rodriguez.
Captain, a while ago I saw, well, birds. A whole flock of them.
Don't you like birds, Mr. Rodriguez?
I like them fine, sir, but...
Hello, I'm Dave Ross.
Hey, and I'm Hampton Yunt.
And we host Suicide Buddies on Starburns Audio.
That's right. It's a podcast about suicide, but not to make light of it. We actually talk about suicidal thoughts, depression, kind of with a sense of levity that Dave and I have with each other. He's my best friend. Come on.
Yeah, we're buddies. Suicide Buddies.
That's the title.
One of our favorite episodes that we've recorded so far is about this guy, Jan Pataki, who was a Polish aristocrat in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And he, one of the reasons it's possible that he killed himself is that he thought he was a werewolf.
Oh.
Check out a clip. It also makes me think, like, we were talking about in the Norway black metal episode, how, like, just the culture of your surroundings can affect you. Like, yeah. He's in a castle in Poland. He's like, I mean, if you lived in a castle in Poland and no one knew anything about anything, you might be like, I'm a bat. I'm probably a bat.
That's like literally what happened to Batman. He literally is in his mansion. He's like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat. I'm a bat.
I'm a
bat that helps people.
I'm a bat that helps people.
I'm a
rich. I don't know what you want from me. And my girlfriend, she's a cat. She's a cat.
My girlfriend's a cat.
She steals things. She's a woman who steals things. She's a cat. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat.
I help people.
She's a cat. We fight a penguin.
My